We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Seemingly is one of those days where I can't get to everything I have. And that typically happens on a Monday, but I have a bunch of stuff that I'm even looking around from here. I'll tell you one thing. Cheryl Atkinson wrote this great piece that is up on her website, which kind of breaks down the Jim Comey testimony, which was lengthy, right? And they revealed the transcript over the weekend, 234 pages. And she went down and sort of ticked off a bunch of different takeaways. And I'm hoping to get to that a little bit later this afternoon. In the meantime, we'll try to put this. Hey, Cole, can we put this up on my site? I'll give you the link to it at KMOX.com/Mark. We'll put the Cheryl Atkinson piece. Of course, she used to be a CBS journalist and is sort of on her own with an independent TV show right now and has been a guest on the show many times. So that's sort of interesting. I did play you what Comey said in the last hour about no impeachment, and we'll have an audio cut of the day. You know what was really good today? I heard on I think it was on CNN or Fox, is the Mooch. Scaramucci was on our show. He's actually working with Entercom, our company, because he does a podcast through the company, and it's pretty interesting, and he came on as a guest, some of you might remember, a couple of weeks ago, and was fantastic. So I heard him on CNN sort of breaking down some of the things that have happened with the Mueller investigation and Comey, and was really good. So he may be featured as my audio cut of the day. We'll have to see what happens. The Critics' Choice nominations came out this morning. This is a group that I belong to, the Broadcast Film Critics Association, and we're going to break down some of those nominations just briefly here with Christian Toto from HollywoodandToto.com, a fellow conservative film critic. Christian, welcome back. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
The Favorite, 14 nominations, leads the way. Black Panther, a bunch of nominations. First Man, a Best Picture nod, which did not happen with the Hollywood Foreign Press last week. So a bit of a rebound for First Man. What did you make of our selections today?
Interesting. You know, it's kind of a nice blend of more artsy films and also more populist films. I saw Mary Poppins Returns is on the list, including Black Klansman, also Black Panther. So it's definitely a potpourri. You know, at the end of the day, it feels like a lot of things lead toward the Oscars, and this certainly makes the picture come into sharper focus. But I think at the end of the day, the best picture is usually two or three films are vying for it. So, you know, it's Black Panther was excellent. I think it's a good movie, and it certainly deserves to be in that conversation. But I still think that the eventual Oscar winner will not be sort of a populist movie. It's going to be a more serious highbrow film.
I think you're right here. And what we do is we nominate 10 pictures. So Oscar changed their rules several years ago. They can go up to 10. The Golden Globes, they break it down into musical or comedy and drama. We talked about that last week. It never makes any sense. But we have Black Panther, Black Klansman. That's the Spike Lee movie. It's excellent. The Favorite, which will open up next Friday in St. Louis, appears to be a stuffy period piece, but it's actually very funny and heavily nominated with Rachel Weisz and Emma Stone. First Man, I mentioned, Green Book, If Beale Street Could Talk, Mary Poppins Returns, which I just loved. I thought it was great, and I think audiences are going to love that. Roma, A Star Is Born, and Vice. So as you kind of go through this process, and I kind of explain it this way, Christian, with our group, you know, the studios tend to think that we telegraph some of these awards pretty well. And my theory is that our makeup is, you know, about 300 critics in there, male, female, good split, older, younger, good split. So that's very similar to the demographic makeup of the Academy voters. Unlike with the Hollywood Foreign Press, we got about 80 people that nobody knows.
That's right. And a pretty small group, by the way, to give out an award that has such name recognition. It's interesting. I also want to talk a little bit about the box office. You know, the Favorite has got about $3 million at the box office right now. It's pretty small. You know, it still may open wider. It may get more attention. Like I said, it's going to be opening in your neck of the woods very soon. But one I want to point out to is Green Book. I just checked the stats on that one. It fell 0.7% last weekend, and it's starting to really gain some steam. It hasn't made a ton of money, but I love the film, and I want more people to see it. And I think it could make some rumbling noises when it comes to the Oscars if enough if sort of the box office kind of swings in, because that's another factor in this.
I think you're right about Green Book, and I think that if you go back a few weeks, people thought maybe that was the prohibitive favorite. Now, I should mention that last year, The Shape of Water led the Critics' Choice Awards with 14 nominations. That was the eventual winner for Best Picture and Director. Of course, they rode that all the way to the Oscars. That was my favorite movie of the year. I think I mentioned this to you last week. Amongst these 10, I can't tell you right now. Maybe on a different day I would vote for a different film. I can't tell you exactly what I would vote for. There's a couple on here I would not vote for, including Vice. I loved Roma from an artistic standpoint, but, you know, maybe a little too artsy-fartsy to win Best Picture. Anything else jump out to you from these selections or these selections that we did compared to the Critics' Choice? Compared to the Golden Globes?
It's trickier this year. I know there's a lot of sort of emotion behind Black Panther, just because not only the diversity it represents, but the fact that there was that populist movie category that they quickly mentioned and even more quickly scotched. I think there's a sense within the Oscars that they want to reach more people, and that if you have a Black Panther as your winner, everyone saw Black Panther, and almost everyone loved that movie. And if you have something like First Man or even If Beale Street Could Talk, it's going to have a much smaller audience. So the push and pull between the commerce and artistry, it's always there. I think it's even more profound this year. But I think at the end of the day, the voters vote the way they vote, and I don't think they'll be swayed by an emotional argument for something like Black Panther.
Yeah. I liked Black Panther quite a bit. I'm in the camp that believes it should not be in this discussion for Best Picture. But, you know, what do I know, right?
Well, it's on the border for me. I think it's a very good movie. I actually had more fun with Ant-Man and the Wasp. And
I did too.
Avengers
yeah.
had more pop behind it, more sort of pop culture whimsy and drama, and the stakes were higher. So, but, you know, those movies very often don't even get in the running. They don't get in the conversation. It's more serious, sober fare. So it's good that it's something atypical is in the mix.
I think I have expressed my anger and disdain for Bohemian Rhapsody with you over the course of the last month or so, but it was interesting. That did not get a Best Picture nomination. I think we kind of got it right there.
Yes, absolutely. And I don't think it's a Best Picture at all, even though I enjoyed it more than you did. But that is not a great movie. You could even argue it's not a very good movie. So I'm fine with that.
All right. Well, we'll see what happens. Our awards are handed out in just a few weeks. The week after the Golden Globes, it's interesting. We used to be before the Golden Globes. That kind of hacked them off, and they moved theirs up to the 6th. We're going on the 13th. The SAG nominations come out on Wednesday morning. Their categories are just a little different with, you know, Best Ensemble, and we do have that for the Critics' Choice, but the category is just a little different with SAG. So we'll see what happens moving forward as we're in the thick of the award season. Next week, you know, nothing really opened up this past weekend, but boy, the next couple of weeks loaded with really good movies.
Yeah, and just a quick note, The Mule with Clint Eastwood, he's directing and starring. I heard from a friend on one of the social media accounts, they're not screening it near him. I'm in Denver. It's not being screened
here. I'm not going to get to see it either. Yeah, I just got the updated list, and that's very unusual. First of all, it's a Warner Brothers movie. They typically don't do this, and with Clint Eastwood, so I'm not sure why. Typically, that means that it's not a very good movie.
Yes, and you know what happened? You know what the last movie that didn't get screened by Clint Eastwood was? The 1517 to Paris, which was a very poor movie, sadly, and that one was not screened as well. So, boy, I hate to see him have an 0-for-2, but I'll cross my fingers and hope there's some other reason for the fact that the critics aren't going to go look at it.
Yeah, I think 90% of the time, maybe even 99% of the time, the reason that they don't screen is they know that the reviews are just going to not help the movie. There were people that were asking me on social just recently whether or not that would be in the awards conversation, because typically a movie like that, especially with Clint Eastwood, would be, but apparently not, because we have not been able to see it. Christian Toto, HollywoodInToto.com. We'll talk soon. Thanks, Christian.
Thank you.
It's 3:14 at the Voice of St. Louis. Daddy Christmas music here as we are just 2 weeks away. My daughter asked me this morning, Daddy, when's Santa coming?
Frosty the Snowman.
I said he's coming. If you're on the nice list, which she is not right now, she's on the naughty list. There's still time to turn that around, though. We got 2 weeks from today. 3:18, my good friend, an amazing musician, a lot of success here. Johnny Holzen coming in the next segment. I think he's got a couple of band members. His band, Well Hungarian, has been around here in St. Louis for 25 years. They're doing a big anniversary show at Del Mar Hall, and John's going to swing in here. They might even play some music in about 10 minutes. So that will be fun. This next topic may be not as fun, but I think it's interesting. And I invited one of the reporters who did this for the Hartford Current on the show. You might remember the Sandy Hook shooting. And I hesitate to even say this guy's name, Adam Lanza. Usually my practice to not do that. But Dave Altomare is with me this afternoon. They went through a bunch of different documents and found some things that are rather disturbing, as you might imagine, about this shooter. Dave joins me this afternoon. Hey, Dave, how are you? Did I pronounce your last name correctly?
Hey, Mark, how you doing? Yes.
Altomare, right?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Sometimes I didn't have that qualified before you joined me, so I wasn't completely sure. So what did you guys set out to do here?
Well, we, 5 years ago, I filed a Freedom of Information request for documents that the state police took out of Adam Lanza's home and turned over to an FBI profiler. And the state police fought the release of those documents all the way through the state Supreme Court, which is why it took so long. The court ruled about a month or so ago that they had to give us the documents. So it took quite a while, took a lot longer than I expected to bring the case to finality.
What was the opposition? I want to get into some of the details. Why were they opposed to releasing those?
Good question.
Yeah.
Not 100% sure. I guess they felt that they were that they didn't have to release them, that they were private records. And you know, some of them are like school records. There are some medical records that were redacted. But you know, there also were a lot of things that turns out a lot of things that were on his computer that had never been seen before.
So you know, as I'm looking at your story here, it just came to me that this was 6 years ago this week, and I was on the air. It was
yes.
a Friday, I believe, and I was on the air when that happened. I remember going home. I've told this story. I cried walking my dogs that night, just thinking about these kids. And, you know, he shot his mom as well. If you would go through my house and try to find 1,000 documents, I don't think you'd find anything close to that with my writing. So where does this stuff come from? What was he doing? Was he keeping a journal, a diary? Where did all this information come from, and what did it tell you?
Some of it was on his computer, on his desktop.
Okay.
For example, he kept this spreadsheet of mass murderers dating back to 1786.
Wow.
There were 400 names on it. There were 17 categories, different categories for each person. It was a meticulously crafted document that probably took him years of research. We believe probably researching it and writing it for about 4 years, kept on his computer. There were also other documents on his desktop, a four-page, I guess I'd call it a screenplay about pedophilia, another document that he entitled Me, which talked about suicide, familicide. So there were a lot of things that ended up, you know, turning out to actually take place when he ultimately went into the school.
He was I don't even know how some of this stuff kind of ties together, but some of the details are very strange. Like, he was a big germophobic, right?
Extreme. Wouldn't touch a doorknob. Hated to have people in his room. If his fork hit the floor, he wouldn't eat his meal. He also, he hated fat people. There was a lot of stuff about, you know, bones being pure, and he had a lot of derogatory things to say about fat people, which was interesting because he was a 6 foot kid. He weighed 112 pounds on the day of the shooting. So he was, there was not
wow.
much to him. And so I had a lot of, you know, he was definitely obsessive, definitely liked violence, obviously. So some of those things we knew, a lot of them we didn't, or we got more information about through these documents.
Yeah. So you wrote this in the piece, and this sort of, you know, jumps out, and I think this is what you had hoped with a writing like this. Dave Altomare is my guest with the Hartford Courant. You said one thing becomes clear, and you did this with a writing partner too. One thing becomes clear as the additional records are examined. Adam Lanza, from about ages 3 to 18, was never off the radar of people who orbited him. His parents, the teachers and counselors in the schools he attended, the psychiatrists who later tried to figure out what was happening with him. It is evident now that no single person grasped the full picture of what he was becoming. That, you know, I guess you can say maybe that's not so weird because you wouldn't expect someone to turn into such a sociopath and kill his mom while she's in her bed and then, you know, kill all those children. But that's interesting because people knew that he was messed up, and that's kind of underselling the situation.
He was definitely, you know, someone that the school system tried to help, no question. He also went through the Yale Child Study Program. So there were, I don't think anybody fully put together how bad off he was, or how, you know, or tried to in some way intervene. And he obviously just got worse as he progressed to the point where he became basically so isolated that he didn't talk to anyone, not even his mother. He only communicated with his mother, who lived in the same house, by email towards the end. So he had become just basically the ultimate loner.
There was an expert from Yale who met Adam Lanza and asked this question. This is Robert King, who's a psychiatrist. Are there kids you enjoy spending time with? He was 14 at the time at the Yale Child Study Center, 2006. Why would that be significant? That was Lanza's question. And King describes him as pale, gaunt, awkward. The mom pipes up and says her son was much more relaxed at home and his stiffness and tension was due to being here. And then he asks, what is a friend? What's a friend? That's, you know, a simple question. It is difficult to define. In whose culture do you refer? That's a 14-year-old kid answering the question that way.
Right. Yes. Yeah. And then he became even more and more isolated as he went along. There's clearly something that occurred between when he was a student at Sandy Hook and when he entered high school. His mom tried putting him in a Catholic school. She tried homebound schooling. You know, it wasn't that they didn't try. She didn't try several different avenues. She even had him go to college, actually, while he theoretically was still supposed to be in high school. So they definitely tried different things. It just was no one ever put together, how violent he would become. He was never arrested and never had any incidents at school. No one could have foreseen that he would become, you know, to do something like he did on 12-14.
You mentioned the pedophilia. How does that play into this? Was he a pedophiliac?
It's just an odd thing that makes you wonder. There's no evidence. There's no evidence of it.
Did he write about it?
He did. He wrote a screenplay about a relationship between a 30-year-old man and a 10-year-old boy.
All right, that was the screenplay. I got you. Yeah,
he wrote a little bit about homosexuality. So he was clearly whether that was just an interactive, you know, whether that was just in his mind or whether that he was, you know, reciting something that had happened to him earlier in his life, we'll never know. But it was an odd thing to come out of nowhere and you got to remember, those were documents that no one ever saw. They were on his computer, on his desktop. We don't think anybody ever saw them.
I don't know what you are hoping, and not that there has to be something as a takeaway that you would hope for, but it's interesting to me because, look, if you read this, if you take time to read, it's very detailed, your reporting here, and it's frightening and, you know, brings that ill feeling that maybe people had 6 years ago back to the forefront. But obviously, Dave, and I'm not expecting you to get into politics here, but let me toss out the question this way. Gun control comes up all the time. Sandy Hook is cited a lot for gun control. But when you look at this, I mean, my takeaway is going to be different than other people. You see how disturbed this person is. And some people would say, look, you can't do anything about evil. I mean, some people are truly evil, whether it's evil or mental illness. I'm not sure what was at play with this guy, but there were a lot of things that were happening that never, ever happened to a lot of different people out there. Maybe there is some common bonds with other mass shootings, but is there a takeaway for people kind of looking forward? Because the hope is always to avoid these things in the future.
Right. I think that's part of the reason why we felt it was important to publish, to get these documents and to publish, to get more information out about this guy and to see were there mistakes that were made along the way in the school system or somehow that could have been avoided, or are there red flags that if you see in a person, maybe the next time somebody will take more effort to help that person and stop it from becoming what happened here. She bought the gun. I mean, the gun was legally owned by Nancy Lanza. She purchased the Bushmaster that he used. I think the question becomes, if you look at these mass shootings, I mean, almost invariably it's an AR-15 that is used. And I think the question is, it's a gun that kills people fast. He shot 150 something bullets in 5 minutes, and then he killed himself. I mean, he probably could have shot another 150 more.
Yeah.
So, that's where it comes in as far as the weapon of choice for a lot of these guys. He happened to own one because his mother bought him one, so it was legally owned.
Yeah, Dave Altomare from the Hartford Courant, and I appreciate you coming on here and talking about this. Well, I found it in the LA Times, they reprinted today. It's a really, really interesting, detailed report. You guys did a lot of work on this, and thanks for sharing it. And unfortunately, it's on the anniversary week of a terrible, terrible tragedy. I can't even imagine how you guys feel in Hartford compared to the rest of the country, just having to go through these memories again. But thanks for joining me, Dave.
All right, thank you.
Listen to those harmonies. The Well Hungarians, and John Holzem is with me in studio with a couple of his bandmates as they're about to celebrate 25 years here of playing music in St. Louis. Todd Jones and Joey Minor also here. Johnny, how are you?
Life is grand, man.
Todd and Joey, good to see you guys again.
Thanks.
You too.
Are you guys amazed that someone with as little talent as John Holzem could have this much success over the course of 25 years? I'm just going to start with that.
Wow.
All right,
Isn't it? No, I can give him trouble because we're really good friends and we go to concerts together. And I did something really stupid because I have a Christmas party that is scheduled for this weekend and I've been planning it for a while and I knew there was a conflict in the date, but it's the same date as your show on Saturday night at Del Mar Hall. So for that, I apologize. Because
I don't think the wife will care if you slip out.
This thing's driving me so crazy at this point. I might just slip out. And then I could, my party starts early. I can come, stay there for a while, slip out, go to Del Mar Hall, and then come back. But anyway, congratulations on 25 years. And you guys here's what's frustrating. And Todd and Joey might not have this perspective. I've told the story before, but here's what happens. John and I go see a show, right? Mm-hmm. What would be an example of something we saw recently? I don't even know. Because we've gone to a bunch of shows. But let's offer an example.
Creighton's guy.
So we go to Fogarty, right? Yeah. So we're at that a few years ago. And granted, I'm a radio guy, so people don't know what I look like.
Right.
But
right.
I do a little television. But people come up all the time. No, this is embarrassing, but we went to Shania Twain. I took him to Shania Twain.
Yeah, that's right.
So
yeah,
we're in the concourse at, Enterprise Center, then Scott Trade, I believe.
Right.
And one after another, people coming up. Aren't you John from the Well Hungarians? And I'm just sitting there rolling my eyes, trying to tell people he's not that freaking cool, But
see the pain I endured to be his friend.
Story of my life.
I know. Yeah, you guys have to deal with it all the time.
You are the wingman.
On a serious note, there's a reason that people recognize you because you've been doing these gigs for so long in this area, right?
Yeah, man. It's the 25 years of Well Hungarians, which is, I don't know, 6,000-7,000 shows. And then, I spent a good 10 plus years before that playing in the scene as well. So just over time, people see your face all the time in the clubs and fairs and wherever, events.
The wineries. You play out in the wineries quite a bit.
Absolutely. Yeah. So just over time, they're going to see that face and correlate the two together. So
a few years ago, we did a KMOX profile, which airs occasionally. So I got to learn a little bit about the background and how the band came together. I'm surprised you haven't been forced to change the name of the band just because it sounds like a Me Too moment to me.
Well, thanks for opening that can of worms, man.
Right. How did that go? So what, tell the story of the name. Obviously, it's a fun, it's a unique name. It's a fun name. It's a bit of a double entendre.
It's
right?
Exactly all it is. When the band,
yeah, it's sophomore. I like that stuff, though. I'm very sophomore.
Came together. We weren't actually a band. A club owner called. The band that he had scheduled had canceled. He said, hey, Johnny, can your band play? The band I had at the time, can your band play? We weren't available, so I said, you know what? Let me call a couple of buddies. I'd known Todd. Todd's one of the greatest guitar players to ever come out of St. Louis. I'm like, I want to do at least a show with this guy at some point in my life. Call Todd. He calls a buddy. I call another guy. We just threw something together. Wasn't a band. Threw a little acoustic thing together, and someone yells out there in the show, hey, what's the name of the band? Well, a friend of mine had said, years back, wouldn't Well Hungarians be a funny band name? And we all thought, yeah, funny band name. Not a serious band name, but a funny band name. So we say Well Hungarians, have a good laugh at it. Ha ha ha. End of the story. Until the next night, the club owner wants us to do it again. Again, what's the name of the band? Oh, Well Hungarians. Ha ha ha. Again, end of story. 2 weeks later, hey, you guys want to do that every Tuesday over at my other place? Yeah. Sure. So it was still just a stupid, funny, goofy double entendre name, sophomoric.
Sophomoric, name. Yes, yes.
But as the band grew, as the popularity grew,
that's
the name
funny.
Stuck, and here we are 25 years later with what I want to say is an innocuous name, but
well,
people like you still bring up the sophomore
content. But you know what, though? It's really a good name, and I'm trying to think there was a band. I was trying to Google something here because I'm drawing a blank, but there was a band in Kansas City that I used to go see every once in a while that my buddy Gary Poole knew the band members of. It. It was something similar where it had a play on words and was inappropriate. So every once in a while you get something and it sticks and it's been very successful. But so, Todd, you've been with us from the beginning, but sort of on sabbatical. You got sick of him and then left for a while too, right? Well, this is going to keep up if you're not familiar with the tone, right?
Yeah, sick of it, fed up.
No, but you're doing other projects, right?
I took leave back in 2011, but yeah, I'm one of the original. I'm one of the original guys that, like you said, it started as a fluke, and we just kept doing it and had a great time. Had a great time.
And Joey, how long have you been with the band?
Almost 5 years now.
Yeah, we did. You were out there when we did the deal at the Sound Room, right?
Yes.
Were you there? Yeah, we had a little bit of a performance when I did my show live at the Sound Room. That was
yes,
pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
All right, John, so 25th anniversary show. This is a big deal, and congratulations on it, as much grief as I give you.
Well, thank you.
And it's, you know, to have that long of a run in this region and all the success and the fans. So you are doing, well, a couple things coming up. The anniversary show is at Del Mar Hall this Saturday. So if you're not invited to my party, which most people aren't, there might be a couple of people, you can go, you get permission. Or even if you are, you can do both things that night. What are the details? This is an all-ages show.
It's an all-ages show. You get tickets at the door, or you can go to Ticketmaster.com to search Well Hungarians. The doors are at 7 o'clock, show's at 8 o'clock, and it's going to be a pretty long show. We're covering the entire history, all the original music, and a lot of the classic or cover favorites that we've done over the years that people have grown to know as
being marquee songs of ours. You know, I think people think of you maybe country, but I'm hesitant to pigeonhole you in that because there's country influence, but it's not country.
No, I always say all the time, we're a band. We're not a country band, a rock band, whatever. When it comes to original music, just whatever you produce has to get put into a category. And being a band with major harmonies and great instrumentation between Todd's guitar and the fiddle for Joey and things of that nature, it just made sense to place us in more of a country genre. You know, but the influence is a lot of classic rock, southern rock, singer-songwriter stuff. Then, of course, there's tons of great old country influences, but that's on the original side. On the cover side of things, it's everything from Bruno Mars and Justin Timberlake to George Strait and Alan Jackson to Toto and Little River Band or Blink 182 and you know, whatever. Whatever the show needs from us is what we'll bring. Now, but at the show this Saturday, it's going to be all the original stuff and some of, as I say, the marquee cover songs that we've been known for over the years.
Well, you also have a New Year's Eve show that you're doing in Columbia, Illinois at the Falls Reception Center, so there's some packages available for that, but I guess all of this can be found up on your website for Well Hungarians. You guys are going to play a little music for me also this
evening,
aren't you?
Absolutely, yes, sir.
What are we going to do?
I think Helplessly Hoping is the way to go. The old classic song from Crosby, Stills, and Nash, song that we recorded back on our 2004 album, Sorry About the Mess. And I tell people all the time, since the first night, we've performed this song pretty much every night all the way up to right now. And it's just something that's you know, the test of time has definitely been a good one for this song.
The Well Hungarians 25th anniversary show. I know I tease him, but I love John Holzem. He's a great dude. You even have a, you know, a great foundation that you raise money for. We promote that over the course of the year as well.
Thank you.
Congratulations on the great run. And I know that the fans will come out this weekend. There are tickets available. Let's play some music here, guys.
We can do that, man.
Todd and Joey and John Holzem, the Well Hungarians.
Helplessly hoping her Arlequin hovers nearby, awaiting a word. Gasping at glimpses of gentle true spirit, he runs, wishing he could fly. I only to trip at the sound of goodbye. I wordlessly watching, he waits by the window and wonders at the empty place inside. Heartlessly helping himself to her bad dreams, he worries, did he hear a goodbye? I, or even hello? They are two alone. They are three together. They are four each other. Stand by the stairway, you'll see something certain to tell you. Confusion has its cost. Love isn't lying, it's loose in a lady who lingers, saying she is lost and choking on hello. They are one person, they are two alone, they are three together, they are four each other.
Yes, the Well Hungarians. That was great. Joey Minor with those, those were high notes. I almost wonder if you have a pliers down below in the Netherlands or something like that.
They got the pliers down below.
All right, John. Well, listen, thanks for coming in, guys. It's great to
my
see
pleasure.
You. And anything I didn't get out there detail-wise about the show coming up this weekend?
Not about the show, but I have to give credit to, you talk about 25 years of me doing this, that, and the other. This is not a fluffy, happy moment. I'm not trying to stroke anybody, but it's all of these guys over the years of doing this and us doing it together has made it happen. 17 years with Todd or one year with Boone Wheeler. This truly is the magic of all of these guys that have spent time on stage together that have made it what it is and continues to give it a legacy to where we can continue to go on and play shows, a couple hundred shows a year. So all credit due to all of these men who have put time in with the group.
Well, you guys got a big fan following and well-deserved. The big anniversary show, Del Mar Hall. Have a great holiday season. Merry Christmas, John Holzem. We'll see you soon. We'll go out and hit a show so people can recognize you and I'll feel stupid, right? That's my life. Thanks, guys. Good to see you.
All
thanks,
Mark, John.
Good luck. And I want to try to get to this just briefly here on the Jim Comey stuff from the other day. And maybe that'll segue into Cut of the Day as well. So the 234-page transcript from his testimony from Friday, which was closed, was released on Saturday. And, I think it maybe got lost in the shuffle over the weekend. Cheryl Atkinson, former CBS reporter, and she's got her own show now that's syndicated throughout the country, including here, I think Channel 30 airs it on Sunday mornings. She kind of broke this down point by point. It's a really good report. And she sort of highlights the different details that came out of this testimony. Comey, for example, confirmed that Peter Sturk and Lisa Page, those controversial FBI lovers who served on the team investigating Hillary Clinton's email, Sturk and Page were pulled from the special counsel Robert Mueller probe in 2017 after the inspector general discovered they had exchanged many pejorative text messages. And I think we know about those right now. So Comey says that he would not have allowed them to serve on the Hillary email investigation if he had known about the private communication. That was said the other day. So that seems to be an acknowledgement that the FBI investigation was tainted or has the appearance of being tainted by bias. Then on the topic of Loretta Lynch, Comey said the tarmac meeting between Loretta Lynch and former President Clinton 5 days before Hillary's FBI interview was problematic and potentially inappropriate. He acknowledges he didn't take steps to find out the substance of the conversation. That's on pages 33 and 34 of that testimony. He says he learned of material that, if made public, would be used to cast doubt on whether Lynch had acted appropriately in the investigation. He did not say what the material entailed. So a little context there, Cheryl points out. He first revealed the existence of the Lynch material in his book. According to a report on CNN, the material may refer to discussions between Lynch and Clinton staffer Amanda Renteria or former DNC chairwoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz. However, Lynch has denied discussing any aspect of the investigation. So what's the analysis? She says Lynch, McCabe, Sturck, and Page, or Strzok, however, I'm still not sure how to pronounce that, were key players in the email probe who ended up with conflicts of interest or the appearance of bias. Comey expresses no concern over the question of whether Lynch's tarmac meeting and refusal to recuse may have amounted to obstruction of justice, which I think is interesting. And then they go down the list. The email investigation, the FBI interview, and she runs down all the things that Comey said, drafting the memos, saying that she shouldn't be prosecuted. Of course, she came out, or he came out, with that big news conference, which was pretty damaging, I think, to Hillary Clinton. And Cheryl's context here is with Comey stating that A.G. Lynch was potentially conflicted and that she should have recused herself. It's unclear why her agency, the Justice Department, was allowed to call important shots on the FBI's procedures and why Comey, who was, of course, FBI director, wasn't more read in on an investigation involving a woman most thought would likely be the next president. So basically, if you look at the breakdown here, Cheryl took a lot of work and a lot of time, and she went through the Steele dossier. You know, they ask him about that. They go through a bunch of different issues, and she breaks it down and offers references to what Page in that testimony. I think the bottom line is still a lot of questions to be answered here by Jim Comey. He said, and I wish it was an open session, he said there was no reason to not have it an open session. I think if you look at the answers here, he's probably right about that. But the answers also create more questions.
Playback ready. Initiating sequence. Now, the audio cut of the day.
And cut of the day is sponsored by the Good Feet Store. Flex spending and gift cards available. Some credit restrictions apply. Let's use Jim Comey from the weekend talking about Donald Trump, not his favorite person in the world. He was asked whether or not he thinks impeachment is a good idea moving forward. His answer might surprise you, although he does have a reason for that.
I hope Donald Trump is not removed from office by impeachment, because it would let the country off the hook. And it would drive into the fabric of our nation a third of the people believing there was a coup. And we need a moment of inflection where we all get off the couch and say, that is not who we are. And in a landslide, rid ourselves of this attack on our values.
So he's basically saying, let the American people make the call in 2020, which might be a little dangerous for Democrats considering their group of wacky candidates. But I don't know that I disagree with him on that. Probably a better route than impeachment. Tell that to Adam Schiff and the rest of the Democrats. That's your audio cut of the day. It's sponsored by the Good Feet Store. Total Information PM coming up next on KMOX.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.